Tokyo Podcast episode number 36.
On this show, I talked to clinical psychologist Mr. Andrew Grimes about some of the cultural and financial reasons why Japan has such a high suicide rate. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Tokyo Podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Joe. And on today's show, we are going to be discussing a rather serious topic, which is the extremely high suicide rate here in Japan. If you don't know, Japan is one of the leading countries in regards to suicide, with an average of 30,000 people a year taking their own lives. And that equates to about 82 people per day. And when I first heard that statistic, I was actually living in a small town in Canada, and it really struck me because the population of the town I was living in was about 300,000 people. So 10% of the city of my town I was living in was disappearing every year in Japan. And with a declining birth rate and an aging society, this is obviously a cause for concern amongst the authorities and the government here in Japan. And what kind of prompted me to seek out this issue was a blog post by popular YouTube creator Hiko Simon. And not that Hiko Simon is considering committing suicide, but if you don't know, Hiko Simon has a website, a blog called hikosimon.com, where he does quite a bit of writing. And if you've never checked out his writing, I would highly encourage it because he is an excellent writer. He's a very engaging writer. And so he has recently started writing some posts about his early days here in Japan, and his latest one discusses some of these stresses and frustrations that he dealt with in his early days here when he was working for a Japanese company. He was going through some personal relationship difficulties at the time, and combined with the pressures of the company, he found that there was no outlet for his emotion. Japan is a society where there isn't a lot of options for discussion of your personal problems. It's not something that you can do in the workplace. And even people that you might consider close friends or colleagues are reluctant to get into any type of discussion that involves personal relationships or personal feelings. So Hiko writes a very excellent post titled Hard Landing, in which he talks about his early days working in the Japanese company, the pressure to succeed in the company, combined that with the difficulties that he was having in his relationship, all led to a lot of stress and pressure in his life. And he talks about how he was able to overcome that with Japanese friends and actually through surfing. Many countries and many people around the world, you always try to look for some type of outlet to deal with work stress or relationship stress. You know, some people turn to a negative outlet such as eating or drugs. But I would say that mostly in the West, your friends and colleagues would be supportive and try to get you to turn that energy into something positive. But here in Japan, they really kind of encourage, I wouldn't say openly, but maybe culturally encourage people to keep it all bottled up. I think that's why sometimes you get these Japanese people who go completely bonkers when they go to karaoke or a baseball game or something, because it's one of the few areas where they can absolutely let loose. But Hiko Simon talks about how surfing allowed him to kind of let loose and get rid of the emotions that he had bottled up that he wasn't able to express to his work colleagues or even during his work. So it's a fantastic article. I would highly recommend everyone reading it. The title of the blog is hikosimon.com, and the article titled is Falling with Style, Hard Landing, and I will post a link to that on my website at tokyopodcast.com. One of the most disturbing records that Japan holds is that it boasts one of the highest suicide rates in the world. Some estimates place the number of suicides as high as 30,000 per year. And to give you an idea of just how high that is, consider that that number works out to 82 suicides per day. My guest today is Mr. Andrew Grimes, who is a board-certified clinical psychologist and psychotherapist and founded the Tokyo Counseling Service in 1999. He joins me today to talk about how the issue of mental health is dealt with here in Japan. Hello, Andrew. Welcome to Tokyo Podcast.
Hello, Anthony. Thank you for having me. It's very nice to be here.
Now, can you just give us a quick background for our listeners as to how you ended up in Japan?
Yeah, the very short story, Anthony, is that I studied as part of a degree course, a minority in Oriental Studies. And at the end of that time, I thought it would be nice to come and see modern Japan because my history lessons, geography lessons on that program kind of only took me up to about just pre-war. And so I wanted to get away and see what Japan was like beyond the, you know, the traditional images of geisha and kimonos and everybody going around on rickshaws and things like that. So I was just curious to see what modern Japan was like. And I decided to come out here for 1 year, 1 or 2 years. And that was 25 years ago.
Wow. That's a common story, I think, with many expats who come to Japan. They come for 1 year and then stay for 25.
No, absolutely, you're right. Yeah, I mean that. I've put it another way. I think I've yet to hear of anybody saying I definitely came decided to come out for 25, 30 years.
So I wanted to talk to you today a little bit about this issue that Japan kind of has, which is its high suicide rate.
Yeah,
and as a psychologist yourself, I'm sure you've dealt with this issue many times in your career here in Japan. Can you kind of give us an idea of where do you think this issue comes from? Why is it? It almost seems like it's accepted here for people to choose this option.
Yeah, there in a lot of Western media outlets, Anthony, newspapers and 1 or 2 minute soundbite reports on the subject and on forests, which is the, you know, like a perennial or even a triennial that is going out at the moment. Everybody's talking about the suicide forest at the moment in the media. I don't think people really get to the depth of what the problems necessarily are. Obviously, it's a very distressing situation, but it isn't something. Often people will, in media articles, talk about that there is no kind of moral prohibition against suicide. Historically, that it's not a Christian Judeo society, and therefore it's not a sin. And also, occasionally, people will point out that there, you know, there never has been any law against committing suicide. Which I find interesting, but if one thinks about it, really, only very few societies ever made it illegal to kill yourself, because I think it was always very hard to actually prosecute people once they've killed themselves. That applies to such a strong argument. What people tend to go back to is seppuku. Sometimes they refer to it, as I'm sure you know, as harikiri.
Right.
Harikiri, I believe, was actually the word used by soldiers. It's more of like a military slang word. So amongst soldiers, which I think is maybe how during the war that the Allied soldiers, maybe perhaps prisoners of wars and others, got to know the word harikiri. The actual word for committing ritual suicide is seppuku. And the last actual case of seppuku was somewhere around about, I think it was 1967, somewhere there. And that was the writer Mishima. And he was the last person. So, I mean, we're talking at least 40, nearly 50 years ago since anybody attempted that traditional method of suicide here. And it was actually outlawed in the Meiji period at the beginning of the 19th century, just after the 19th century, before the war. So when people talk about this aspect that that it's an option, as it were, in people's thinking, historically it was a requirement under the duty and honor code of the Bushido way of thinking, and to be loyal to your like your baron or your duke, which was called a daimyo. And so it's been historically within the culture. But most people who committed suicide that way were actually ordered to do so. It was never a voluntary process. It was never an individual making a decision because life was tough.
That's interesting that you said that in the old times that the seppuku was not committed voluntarily. Yep. I think that is probably a bit of a myth that perhaps many people have, is that of the, you know, the image of the noble samurai committing ritual suicide. And I think maybe that kind of nobility that's looked at that has carried over to modern times.
Oh, I agree with you completely there. I think that there is an unintended, how can I call it, almost romanticization, an orientalization perhaps, of what is the Western perception of the reasons, as you just said, behind seppuku itself. Yeah, I agree with you completely there. It was a matter of, it was part of the honor code, and it would be done at the orders of the daimyo or even higher, the shogun, you know. And we have movies like, you know, the based on the book Shogun in the West. And so I think that to some extent, yes, there's been a mystification and orientalization of the whole issue. There is the famous story that you may have come across, Anthony, about the 47 Ronin.
Yes.
Yep, right. Well, those guys, you see, I think they do reflect the honor and the, I think what it reflects to me, though, reflects the honor system, but it also reflects what I think still is very strong in Japanese culture in a positive way. And that is vocation and service.
That's interesting that you mentioned vocation and service, because those are two things that seem to be extremely strong in Japanese culture. And it would seem that here, people's vocation gives them their identity. But in the Japanese, it's even the language is geared to that. Your identity comes from your vocation or your service.
Absolutely. I agree with you completely there.
And then with the loss of that vocation and service, it's almost like a loss of identity. And no matter what culture you come from, for people, losing their identity is, you know, a huge cause for depression and anxiety and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, totally. I'm absolutely with you there. I mean, as you're saying, when people get depressed, if they have anywhere in the world, you lose your job, you lose pride and self-respect to some extent. If unemployment, anyone who's listening to this who's ever been unemployed for anything over a few weeks will know that it's a very depressing thing to be. I think that that if you imagine that somebody in the West had lost their job, they had lost their community for some reason. I mean, we're here in a post-disaster situation as well. So obviously, this sense of total disaster is affecting still a lot of people in Fukushima and Tohoku, as I'm sure we both know. I think it's a very positive thing as while you're part of the company, because I think in Japan, let me put it, perhaps an offbeat angle, but one thing that you may have heard as well, Anthony, is that people will sometimes say, you know, I've been in Japan such a long time, and yet I have no male Japanese friends.
Right, I've heard that.
You heard that, right. And that is put around, and some people get very annoyed by this, and, you know, they say, well, if I spent an equal period of time in another country, I'd expect other things and have more friends and so on. And that's perhaps a second issue we might get onto, might not, but about what people expect of, you know, and kind of project on what they expect in their own countries. But in the company, in the group, I look upon them in a way that really it's like being, when you're accepted into a company, you're really being accepted into an enormously large extended family.
Interesting.
If you look at it from that point of view, okay?
Right.
Then then, you know, if that company went bankrupt, for example, and all the employees, you know, it's completely gone, and you couldn't then have that retirement job for 5 years with a company that has a connection traditionally, you know, and you were just suddenly completely torn away. I mean, that is the effect of like having a natural disaster rip away the office and everything and everyone you've ever known. And that's why lifetime employment and the reluctance to let people go, to sack people from companies here all through the 90s and earlier up to the present day, is due to the sense of that somebody has committed their life to the company, and the company doesn't want to betray that trust. So if going back to what you're saying, if somebody then loses their job, then yes, I agree with you completely. They've in a much deeper sense, lost the sense of identity.
In the West, losing your job is obviously, you know, a major life-changing moment, and it can be cause for depression. But typically, your friends will try to encourage you by, you know, trying to point other aspects of your life. Hey, maybe now you can spend some time working out or reading or doing some other hobbies. So there's these outlets that are available to try to focus your energies on. Here in Japan, when someone loses their job, typically what is their response to that? What are options are available to them?
Well, that's a very good question. My first reaction would be say, well, there aren't those same kind of options in a way. But again, anybody who's been unemployed for a long period of time, and if you are paying off a house anywhere in the world, then and you suddenly can't pay the mortgage, then with all the encouragement in the world to go and do other things, I think if you basically, if the loss of your job has caused you such economic hardship, then I think most people will be focused on trying to get the next job, right?
Right.
Okay. So if we look, you know, if we look at the majority of people, and I think in Japan's case, the majority of people are in hard economic conditions. A lot of people, individual small businesses went bankrupt at the end of the 90s and all ever since. And other companies have let a lot of people go against that lifetime employment expectation they had. So a lot of people were not geared up to saying, well, I'll now go and, start doing tennis and start doing other things that I'd always planned to do. Because the tennis club was part of that particular company. Yeah, I've literally known people, Anthony, who've... they would work for large banks or large corporations, let's say, without naming one specifically. And up in, for example, Karuizawa, they had their, this is before the stock market bubble burst, they built these enormous, beautiful recreation centers. And people from all the different branches of the company would come together, and they would meet their husbands and their wives there. That's how they came together. So... And then, as you know, some people live in company-provided dormitories and accommodation. And that is still the case sometimes, and was the case when I first came here in Japan a lot. And so you can be losing your home, you can be losing your identity and position in your society where you go and play tennis and do all those other things for stress relief. Because the people you did that with, they've also been laid off, and they're all too busy trying, you know, to get a job. And they are aware of the fact that other companies will have their own kind of ethic and group, and the other companies may also be in economic situation where they're not in a position and haven't been for the last 10, 15 years to take on a lot of new people as recruits, especially taking on somebody mid-career.
Right.
That's one of the hard problems. This is why the suicide rate, although recent articles have focused on the increase in the number of young people and graduates, has gone over 1,000, unfortunately, who couldn't find jobs and committed suicide last year. But in fact, as is consistent with other countries, in fact, Anthony, about 3/4 of the people who commit suicide here are men. And of that number, about 70%, they're doing so in their 40s and 50s and 60s in those generations, because I think they run out of hope and options. They don't have any other options. We as mental health care professionals here in Japan, we keep an eye on the unemployment rate. Because if the unemployment rate is going down, then even people without a job, they can have hope that things are going to get better. And even if they're depressed, they think they can be. They're able to think, well, there's a chance that new jobs will come up. I might be one of the ones who can get one. Whereas if the unemployment rate is going up, people lose hope. Especially they've been unemployed 6 months or a year, long-term unemployed. So when the unemployment rates go up, we pay very careful attention at those times, as far as we can, because that's an indicator, that the suicide rate will follow. It's like a leading indicator, as it were.
And, recently I read an article by, Hiko Simon, who's a very popular blogger here in Japan, talking about his early days working in a Japanese company. Yeah. And he was going through some relationship issues at the time, and the stress of the company was a lot. And he attempted to kind of, share some of his problems with a coworker. Mm-hmm. And in the article, he talks about how that didn't go over very well. And it was actually some other Japanese friends who took him surfing and kind of allowed him to work his issues out that way. What do you think it is about the Japanese culture that prevents people from sharing their issues or problems with others?
Well, it's interesting. I heard you and Hiko Simon on one of your podcasts, actually, but I haven't heard the particular article by him about this. Yeah, but he's very knowledgeable. He's been in Japan a long time, right?
Yes.
I think he's well aware of these things.
Because, you know, in the West, your first counseling service, your first counselors will be your friends.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, you'll go out, as you were saying, you know, they'll take you surfing, they'll get to the beach, suggest something, you know, go away for a weekend, fix you up with a blind date, whatever, depending on your circumstances.
Right. But here it doesn't seem to be that option is available. It seems that people are reluctant to discuss their personal problems with others, and that seems to only exacerbate the problem further.
Yeah, I take your point. I mean, I think what will happen is in the West, they'll take you to the bar, they'll take you surfing, and they'll take you to other places because they then want to get down, right, and then talk, as you're saying.
Right.
And share, like, the first type of... I mean, we're all counselors in that sense, definitely. Before counseling ever existed, we get around in a tribe and we talk to each other after the battle.
Right.
We're having a rough time, we go with a good friend or even a colleague, and we, you know, say, you know, I've got to tell you, man, truth is, you know, I'm just having a rough time. I've just X, Y, Z's just happened in my life.
Right.
And hope for it, you know, I'm usually have a sympathetic reaction that way. But here it's a similar thing that you take people away to the beach and this, that, and the other. But I think in Japan, and I think I heard this when you and Simon were talking in your podcast, that you mentioned that you don't criticize people, right?
Right.
So here in Japan, I think with the maintaining of harmony and that it is felt to be more constructive, more useful if you take somebody away for kibun tenkan, which means to change your feelings, and also for you not to dwell on and not to. If somebody says they had a hard time, there could be a couple of reasons. Sometimes people are not sure what to say because they don't know the details of the background. So several reactions can happen. One is that people will in fact listen. And they'll listen for, in some cases, for 5, 10, 20 minutes, even longer perhaps. And then they will say something which seems like totally unconnected, like, hey, there's a really good Batman movie on at the cinema. Do you want to go? Yeah, and I've been there, and everybody, I think we've all been there at some time when we first came to Japan, right? And you say, excuse me, I've just been talking about, you know, my entire family was electrocuted, my company went bankrupt, you know, and we sank into the sea. So, you know, I'm kidding around there a little bit with the images, but in other words, we're talking deeply about something very painful and very troubling, and the response seems to be, have you been listening? You know.
A kind of a lighthearted response that perhaps people weren't expecting.
Yeah, and even sometimes a laughing. And a giggling, as it would seem, from a different culture's viewpoint, and finding, and some people have sometimes been very annoyed, particularly in interpersonal relationships between partners, when one partner is Japanese, one's non-Japanese, because you're talking deeply about something very painful, maybe even crying, and somebody may be seeming to be laughing at it. Whereas people here laugh sympathetically. They laugh here when embarrassed and at a loss of what to say. They then might suggest other things in order, because you're suffering so much, is that they don't feel that they have enough to give you in words. Because words are expression of sympathy, Anthony, through words, I think is less prominent. It has importance, but the sympathy through written words, a message later, not in the moment of expressing oneself, and also to take people away to the surfing and the beach, as we were talking about, to try and help your friend forget their troubles, as we'd say, right?
Right.
And so to help your friends forget your trouble often seems very cool, uncaring, and dismissive. Whereas, in fact, the opposite is true. It's just that there's two different senses of common sense of how you respond to a friend in trouble, of what you do. Often in Japan, joshiki, common sense, for people from one culture, it will be common sense to listen and get involved and say, well, listen, you know, that person never deserved you, or, you know, you'll find another fish in the sea, and many other things like that, you know. Sometimes helpful, sometimes not helpful remarks.
Right.
To engage in conversation and to support that way through words. Whereas more often it's action and quiet sympathy and listening itself, just listening without speaking. Often the silence that is produced in the listening without speaking can be interpreted by people from other cultures as being uncaring and even not paying attention, perhaps. Whereas, in fact, deep listening to somebody is the ultimate mark of an expression of sympathy, but it's not going to be verbalized. It's not going to be, no one's going to say, oh, I really sympathize with you.
What are some of the professional options that people have if they are in a depressed state?
Well, the first thing to do, if people are in a depressed state, or you have a family member or a friend who you're concerned is actually in or very close to what would be referred to as clinical depression, utsubyo in Japanese, then the thing to do is to go to a doctor, and preferably a psychiatrist, of course, as soon as possible. I would always recommend that somebody, if they are considered that they are in clinical depression, that they would see a doctor, particularly if people, Anthony, are not sleeping well in that condition. If they're so down, so tired, and when people are in depression, they are also anxious. Often people focus on, these are generally called mood disorders, and people focus on, oh, you're clinically depressed, or, oh, you have a panic disorder, you have a social anxiety disorder. Whereas, in fact, it's going to be very hard, I think, anywhere, anytime, to find someone who is depressed who's not worried about the fact that they're depressed.
Right.
So anybody. So it's more of a predominance in one overwhelming aspect of experiencing a normal emotion to be low or blue or tired in such an extreme proportion that it affects your perception, your hope about the future. You can't even look at the future without anxiety and worry. And people with anxiety disorders, of course, are low and depressed because they feel anxious all the time. So, and if you're not sleeping, and you haven't slept regularly, or your usual sleeping patterns for at least a period of a week or two, then that's not too early to go and see a doctor.
How is professional counseling services looked at here in Japan? Is there any stigma associated with seeking a counselor?
Not anymore in the way that it once was. And again, I'd say that some media outlets and articles and over the years have referred to the stigma of mental illness in Japan, which at one time certainly did exist. It was after the war, pre-war, but particularly after the war, I think it was associated with people having some form of genetic condition within the family, so that matchmakers and people arranging marriages would always try and look into the history of the family. So people would hide any history of mental illness, because that would affect marriage prospects in a very rough economic condition post-war in Japan. And so now I would say, at least in the last 5 to 10 years, if not longer, as I mentioned just a little earlier, mood disorders, in other words, anxiety disorders, depression, things which, Anthony, are brought about by the stresses of life. Okay, so those kind of mental problems and even developing into full illnesses, which are caused by pressures like moving to another culture, losing your job, economics, the things we've discussed already here so far today. Those things, one thing on top of the other, another, can lead to anybody becoming depressed anywhere, any time in the world. There is a person on the planet who cannot be depressed, no matter, as some people may have other ideas that it's about people who are weak. It's about so many things going wrong at the same time, including the loss of a loved one, the death of somebody. It could be many reasons. But so if somebody gets to that point here in Japan, there is no stigma attached now in going to see a psychiatrist, as it once was. And there are over 14,000 psychiatrists in Japan nationwide. And a lot of those psychiatrists are not working in big monolithic hospitals, which is the old-fashioned image that is still put around about Japan. In the 1970s onwards, a lot of young, progressive psychiatrists, doctors, created their own what I would call psychiatric community clinics, seishinka, especially in Tokyo, Kansai, Kanto here, and all the major big areas, big cities around the country. And these are non-bed facilities, Anthony. A clinic in Japan legally is between 0 to 19 beds, and 20 or over is a hospital. So what they will call the mental health clinics. And if you go to one, there might be one in your neighborhood, and you will see that there's not a bed facility. Nobody in white coats are going to come in and push you into straitjackets or things like that, which I'm not really kidding around too much there. Because 10, 15, 20 years ago, I would have the Japanese partner of an American, Canadian, Westerner come in and be concerned, because the old image of stigma and taboo had led people to think that if you had a mental illness, you'd be pushed into hospital. I'm not saying it didn't exist once, it did. Right. That stigma, which still one or two newswire services that don't really want to do much research but read their previous colleagues' articles over the years, in my opinion, they'll just go through the files and they'll put out the word stigma again.
Right.
Whereas I was, if I may just say this, I was talking to a very experienced Rogerian therapist here. And he's been working here over 40 years, and I interviewed him recently for some research I'm doing. And he said that, in his opinion, 1 in 10 adults in Japan, and this was just prior to the earthquakes last year that this conversation happened, that 1 in 10 people have been to counseling in Japan, 10%. And that's a rising figure now with what's happened with the disasters and everything. So I expect that, I can't put a number on it, Anthony, but I'd say within another 5 years, we'll be looking at getting up to 20%.
Interesting. Yeah, it definitely would seem that getting rid of the stigma here and opening it up a little bit more would help, I think, a lot of people see that they have options. Instead of jumping in front of the trains.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying there. But I think that again, takes a little bit perhaps to reporting on the way that suicide is reported here, particularly in English and Western media form. They tend to focus on blue lights on stations, people jumping in front of trains. Of course, it happens, and people then are focused on other aspects. But the truth of the matter is that there are all sorts of facilities here. You mentioned rehab facilities. There are specialist psychiatrists with buildings I've been into of up to 10 floors, where there is a floor for people in their 20s and 30s who are female. There's the next floor is the same age group for males. These are well-staffed with psychotherapy being conducted by clinical psychologists, nurses, trained and experienced nurses and doctors. So these facilities exist here. I actually think the standard of mental health in community clinics and in major hospitals, like, for example, KO Hospital, there's over 100 psychiatrists attached and on staff at KO Hospital. And they're all very knowledgeable, experienced with all the diagnostical statistical manuals like DSM-4 coming out of America and the World Health Organization manual, which is called ICD-10 at the moment. 11's coming out soon. And these are the ones that codify things like PTSD, depression, anxiety disorders, so forth. They've been translated into Japanese. I'm not going to just go on and sound like an apologist or make a case, but the fact of the matter is that in Japan, I think that the quality of mental health care here is of a world standard. And that doesn't always come across in Western press media reports.
Is the mental health care covered by the National Health Insurance?
Oh, that's a good question. It's a very important question, I think. To see a doctor, yes. There are over 270,000 doctors in the country. As I mentioned earlier, 14,000 of those doctors are psychiatrists. So mental health care through a doctor, through a psychiatrist. So medication, psychiatric medication, if you need medical support for depression and other things, then that is covered, yes. The clinical psychologists, we're very much broader in this country. Clinical psychologists are school counselors, and they are marriage and family therapists and various, they cover a much broader spectrum here of places and work. We provide counseling, and at the moment we are legally allowed to provide psychological and educational support because clinical psychologists are, in fact, licensed in Japan. They are registered through the Ministry of Education, Anthony. And that means that school counselors, that university departments of psychology are staffed by clinical psychologists. And so there is recognition, but we cannot use the Hokensho, the health card, the National Insurance Health Card, for counseling or psychotherapy yet, because clinical psychologists are currently in the middle of discussions with the Ministry of Health, Welfare and Labour. And until we get the licensing by the Ministry of Health, Welfare and Labour, not just the Education Ministry, then unfortunately at the moment counselling and psychotherapy cannot be covered.
And can you tell me a little bit about your clinic and the services that you offer? I understand you offer services in both English and in Japanese.
That's right. Yeah, thank you for the opportunity. Here at Tokyo Counseling Services, I'm very fortunate that about four or five of my Japanese colleagues did their master's training in either Britain or in America. And also, when they got back, they have qualified with the Japan Society for Certified Clinical Psychologists qualification here. And so they can speak English, and obviously they speak Japanese pretty well too. I can get by in Japanese, I work in Japanese, and I'm also fortunate, Anthony, to have another couple of colleagues who themselves are working in other languages, so we can provide counseling at the moment in German and Brazilian, because Nicholas, who is working on my team, he's from Austria, and he's a clinical psychologist in Austria, And he lived in Brazil and worked with street kids for some time in social work and counseling work there. So he works in Portuguese and in German and English. And Heyong, who was lived in France for a long time and speaks fluent French, she was trained in Scotland, in Edinburgh, and her training is at a master's level of in art therapy, and she's counselling here in French, Korean, and English as well. And both of them are learning Japanese and working towards the clinical psychologist qualification as they do.
Right. Excellent. And if people want to find out more information about your clinic, they can visit tokyocounseling.com. And thanks, Andrew. Thanks for coming on the show.
Not at all. I very much appreciate all the questions. And it's an important area that you've helped make your listeners aware of as well, Anthony, because as you said, you know, to get the stigma and other things completely into the history books and get more people help through depression, programs like this do a great deal to help. So I thank you and I appreciate it very much indeed.
Thank you.
Not at all. All the best to you.
Thanks again to Mr. Andrew Grimes for coming on the show and giving us an insight into the current state of mental health care here in Japan. For more information about his clinic, the services that they offer, and the counselors that are on hire, visit tokyocounseling.com. I'd also recommend checking out Hiko Simon's weblog at hikosimon.com. And the article that I was mentioning is titled Hard Landing. It's a very good read, and I hope to see more articles from Hiko Simon in the future. Join me next week when I'll be talking about the world of sports. I'll be discussing a very Canadian sport and a very Japanese sport. So if you're into sports, definitely check out next week's show. Don't forget to visit my website at tokyopodcast.com. If you feel like sending me a comment or feedback, or you want to be on the show, send me a message through Twitter at Tokyo Podcast. And I can also be found on Facebook at facebook.com/tokyopodcast. That's it. Thanks for listening, everyone. I'm Anthony Joe, and bye-bye.